No taunting. No insisting they were right and I was wrong. No hating me for how badly I've treated him and Richard this whole journey. I wonder if James can really be this forgiving, or if he is simply so happy to be off that stinking ship that he has forgotten the past. "Come on in, you prig," calls Richard. "You need a good delousing." That makes me mad. "You're the one who brought the lice onto the ship," I shout. I yank off my shirt and charge into the water. I splash Richard in the face until he begs for breath. When I stop, he is gasping. He smiles a little, as if he wants to pretend it was fun, but I know it was not. My eyes dare him to try and splash me back, or insult me again. I know he will not. He doesn't want to lose another tooth. "Stop, you two," James whines. "Look at the fish." He tries his best to distract Richard and me from our quarrel. I feel tickling on my legs. When I look down into the clear water, I see small blue and yellow fish nibbling on me. The water is warm, so much warmer than the Thames. "I want to live here forever," says James. "I'd never go back to my stepmom, ever. She would think I'd died, and that would make her happy." "I want to stay here too," says Richard. "I wouldn't be cold ever again." I shake my head. "I still want to go to Virginia," I say. "There's a sack of gold waiting for me there. Maybe 10 sacks. Reverend Hunt calls to us from shore.
"Boys, come here. Put your shirts on. The sun will burn your skin."
I wish we didn't have to leave the water, but we do what Reverend Hunt says. Disobeying him would be like disobeying God. When we get to shore, he is holding our shirts and 3 wide-brimmed straw hats.
"The sun here is like 10 English suns, he says. "You put these on."
Reverend Hunt waits while we pull our shirts over our heads and tie the hat strings under our chins.
"Now," he says, "there is work to be done. There are the tents to be set up. The cook wants all the pots scrubbed with sand, and Captain Ratcliffe wants a path cut to the baths. They found hot baths in the forest, and he says the gentlemen can't be tromping through the underbrush to get to them."
Captain Ratcliffe of the beady eyes and pointed nose. Captain Smith grumbles that he doesn't see why the gentlemen can't walk through the forest like anyone else, but Captain Ratcliffe has the power to give orders, not Captain Smith. When we join the others, I see the older boy, Nathaniel. He is holding a hatchet. He must be on his way to help clear the path. I don't want to scrub pots like a woman, so I hurry to get one of the hatchets too. I swing it a few times to feel its weight and power. I want to do a man's job. Henry, Abram, Nathaniel, and several of the sailors stalk toward the forest with their hatchets. I follow them.
"What do we have here?"
Henry turns to look at me, then stops to block my way.
"A scrawny chicken coming to work with the men?"
I don't answer. I want to say I wouldn't be so scrawny if he'd leave more of the food for me. I try to skirt around him and continue on my way, but he puts out one powerful arm to stop me.
"Go back and scrub pots with the other boys," he growls. "You're only getting away."
He yanks the hatchet out of my hands and cuffs me. I glare at him silently as he turns and walks after the others. What is he going to do with 2 hatchets? I hope he chops himself in the leg. Reluctantly, I go find the cook. He is already hovering over Richard and James, showing them how to scoop up a handful of sand with a rag and use it to scrub out the mess pots. They haven't had a really good cleaning in 3 months, so the sand has some hard work to do. I join them, toiling under the hot sun, until sweat drips from my face. I wish I could be back playing in the salty sea, or swinging a hatchet in the shade of the forest. Suddenly, a scream comes from the forest, a man's scream of pain. Soon there is another cry, and then such shouting and shrieking, it turns my blood cold. I remember Captain Smith's answer when I asked if the Caribs chop people up for their cookpot. Only if they catch them. "The path cutters," I shout. "It's coming from that direction." Gentlemen and soldiers grab their weapons and hurry toward the terrible sound. James and Richard huddle together behind the largest cookpot. I spot a sword and belt someone has left lying in the sand. Quickly, I try to fasten the belt around me. It's too big. I pull the sword out of its sheath, and with the bare sword, I run toward the sound of the battle. Down the newly cut path I go, high stepping over stumps and roots, following the soldiers and gentlemen. We all converge on the path cutters. They are yelling and writhing as if they are fighting invisible demons. Henry is hopping, swatting his arms and neck, shouting in agony. There is not a Carib Indian in sight.
"What is this?"
Reverend Hunt demands, his voice booming over the cries.
"What is happening here?"
"Fire!" Henry cries. "It feels like fire!"
I jerk my head around, searching the jungle. Have the Caribs attacked and run off? Or is it some strange beast? I hold out my sword, ready to fight, but I see nothing. The hatchets are all on the ground. Reverend Hunt reaches to pick one up.
"No, Reverend, don't touch it."
It's Captain Smith's voice. Angry red welts are rising on Henry's arms and neck. On Abram and the others, too.
"To the baths,"
Captain Smith orders them.
"That will give you some relief."
They take off running, swatting at themselves as they go.
"It's the manchineel tree,"
Captain Smith says, when things have quieted down.
"The Caribs use its sap to poison their arrows, and it burns like fire. Our men must have chopped into it."
I am impressed with Captain Smith's knowledge. As a soldier, he has already traveled the world and has learned so much. Tromping up the newly cut path at the moment is Captain Ratcliffe. His face is dripping with sweat.
"This all happened,"
Captain Smith says loudly,
"thanks to Captain Ratcliffe and his ridiculous idea of a gentleman's path."
Captain Ratcliffe wipes his brow and scowls. It looks to me as if he would spit in Captain Smith's face if he weren't so overheated. The two men stare at each other, fuming.
"Let's go, everyone. Back to your work,"
Reverend Hunt says. With a wave of his hands, he gets the men moving. It somehow breaks the standoff between Captain Smith and Captain Ratcliffe. Captain Ratcliffe calls after the men.
"I want a new crew to cut the path. Just leave those blasted manchi-whatever trees alone."
Captain Smith shakes his head and mumbles angrily under his breath. I walk back towards the stack of mess pots, waiting to be scrubbed. I carry the sword I borrowed. Captain Smith comes up behind me.
"That needs cleaning," he says.
It startles me. I give him a sideways look. Then I understand he means the sword. The metal is tarnished and even rusting in some places.
"I will show you how to clean it, and when you return it, the owner will thank you," he says.
On the beach, Captain Smith demonstrates to me how to clean the sword with a rag and sand. He says this sand is fine enough to do the job. It is surprisingly similar to cleaning and polishing mess pots. He orders me to do as he has shown me. I reach for the rag. Then I stop. What if I do it wrong? Will he beat me, make a fool of me? I lower my hand. It is better to remain unteachable.
"If you will not obey me,"
Captain Smith says in a low, cold voice,
"there are other, crueler men you may serve instead."
I clench my teeth. Nothing to do but try. I reach slowly for the rag again, scoop up sand, press it against the sword blade, and give it a stroke. I forget to be careful. My finger slides along the blade. I yelp, stick my sliced finger into my mouth, suck on the blood. Captain Smith laughs.
"Ah, I cut my fingers many times learning to clean a sword. Let me see it," he says.
I hold out my finger. It is still bleeding, but the cut is not so deep that it will stop me from using my hand. Captain Smith rips a strip off the rag and ties it tightly around my finger.
"Try again," he orders.
I look up at him. I did it wrong, and yet he did not beat me. I pick up the rag again. I am careful of my fingers this time. I give a short stroke, and another, and another. Soon the rust and the tarnished spots have turned to shine. They gleam in the late afternoon sun. Captain Smith nods.
"Good,"
he says.
"Now return it to its owner before one of these lazy gentlemen calls you a thief."
I run off to find the belt and sheath. They are still lying in the sand. I return the sword to its place. That evening, I hear hammering, and after a while, I go to see what is being built. Have some of the gentlemen decided they need houses instead of tents to sleep in? When I see what it is, my mouth goes dry. A wooden frame, a rope hanging from the highest beam, a noose tied in the rope. Master Wingfield has not forgotten his promise to hang Captain Smith.
Chapter 7
Such factions here we had as commonly attended such voyages, that a pair of gallows was made, but Captain Smith, for whom they were intended, could not be persuaded to use them. Captain John Smith, The True Travels, Adventures and Observations of Captain John Smith.
The next morning dawns clear and warm. Captain Smith is back in chains, and the gallows sits ready. Reverend Hunt calls us together for Sunday services. We meet, gathered around the tree where Captain Smith is chained, so that he can join us. Reverend Hunt's sermon goes on for hours. I think maybe he will not stop until every single one of us has promised never to sin again. He says to tell a lie is a sin, and that any man who lies for his own gain and does not repent will spend eternity in the agony of hell's flames. He looks right at Master Wingfield and Captain Ratcliffe, delivering his sermon with passion. I see Master Wingfield squirm. Captain Radcliffe sets his jaw and stares straight ahead. Captain Newport looks at the two of them and shakes his head. I send up a prayer that Reverend Hunt's sermon will save Captain Smith from his hanging. After services, I bring Captain Smith some food. I wonder if it will be his last meal. Yet he is calm.
"I've been a prisoner before, and I escaped before,"
he says.
"When I was a soldier fighting the Turks of the Ottoman Empire, I was captured and made a slave. They shaved my head, put an iron ring around my neck, and brought me to auction to be sold like a beast."
James and Richard are nearby, and they come closer to listen.
"The other slaves told me it was useless to try to escape. Impossible, they said. But one day we were working in the fields. I was threshing wheat with a threshing bat. My master rode up on horseback with his whip. He cracked the whip, brought it down on my naked back, lashed my skin open. I was enraged. I took my threshing bat in both hands and swung."
He swings his arms as if knocking the cruel master from his horse once again.
"Down he came, and before he could get his footing, I cracked the bat over his head. Then I beat him with the stub until there was no life left in him."
No wonder Captain Smith is unafraid of these pale, weak gentlemen and their threats. If he wants to, he will kill them with his bare hands.
"Then I shucked off my slave rags, put on my master's clothes, and rode off on his horse to my freedom."
Captain Smith finishes his story. The three of us boys are silent. I admire his courage, and I admire the way he talks back to the gentlemen, as if they have no right to lord it over him. I've never known another commoner who had the nerve to do that. Reverend Hunt comes marching up, a ring of keys dangling. He takes the keys to the clamps on Captain Smith's ankles.
"I've convinced them that without you as translator, we will all perish in Virginia,"
he says as the clamps open and fall away.
"Thank you, Reverend,"
Captain Smith says, rubbing his ankles.
"I owe you a favor."
Reverend Hunt gives him a stern look.
"This is the favor I want, then. I want you to at least act as though you have the proper respect for these gentlemen. If you insult them and anger them again, they may choose their pride over their survival in the new world."
Captain Smith nods, and I wonder if he really does plan to be polite to the exalted gentleman from here on in. He is at least as stubborn as I am, so I know it will be hard for him to change. That afternoon the sound of chopping wood rings out over the rumbling of the waves. The gallows is cut up and thrown on the fire, where it nicely roasts our fish for supper. After 6 days on Nevis, I am fatter. The birds are so tame, we pluck them out of the bushes with our hands. The sea is teeming with fish, and the trees are full of fruit. The only natives on the island are afraid of us, and they stay well hidden. I am also cleaner. I have gone twice to the hot pools in the forest to bathe. But now Captain Newport says it is time to leave. We pack up the tents and cook pots, barrels we have filled with fresh water, meat and fish we have dried for the rest of our voyage, and crates full of pineapples, mangoes, plantains, coconuts, and wild bird eggs. We sail past the Spanish islands of Vieques and Puerto Rico. We stop on the island of Mona, just long enough to get fresh water and for a group of gentlemen to go hunting. They leave in the morning, taking a few soldiers with them for protection from the natives. They dress as if they are going pheasant hunting on a cool English morning, in silk doublets, velvet breeches, stockings, shoes, and felt hats, with their powder flasks hanging at their sides. The group returns in the evening, exhausted and faint, carrying what the expedition has killed, 2 boars, 7 iguanas, and the gentleman Edward Brooks. They say Brooks's fat melted inside his body in the extreme heat. Captain Smith has a few choice words to say about gentlemen who are too ignorant to know they should carry enough water on a 6-mile hike in the tropics, and too ignorant to take off their extra clothing when they get hot. But this time he is wise enough not to utter these words where any of the gentlemen can hear him. I did not know Edward Brooks well. He was a passenger on one of the other ships. Still, it is strange to see his pale, waxy skin and his limbs stiff with death. They dig a shallow grave for Master Brooks, and we sail away, leaving him there on Mona. I have dreams that night that the cannibals find his body, dig him up, and eat him. I awake in a cold sweat. I try to calm down, reminding myself that this could not possibly happen. No one digs up a grave for food. Chapter 8.
The 26th day of April, about 4 o'clock in the morning, we descried the land of Virginia. Master George Percy, Observations.
The tween deck seems dark after those sunlit days on the island. We are sailing north now, toward Virginia. Reverend Hunt says we will travel right past Florida without stopping because it belongs to the Spanish. He says that 40 years ago the French had a colony at Fort Caroline in Florida. He tells me how he heard that the Spanish came and massacred all the French settlers, men, women, and children. No, we will not be foolish enough to land at Florida. Foul weather makes the tween deck even darker. Thunder cracks loud as a cannon shot. I look up through the hatch opening and see black storm clouds boiling in the sky.
"Take in the sails,"
Captain Newport orders. Another crack of thunder booms and lightning flashes. I hear the wind whip the rigging against the masts. The sea bucks, and the ship rolls and jerks. Men begin to retch again, as if they were new to seafaring. The rain comes down in torrents, and when we shout that it is flooding the tween deck, the sailors oblige us by covering up the hatch, so that we are shut in the dark with only stale, vomit-scented air to breathe. Lanterns are lit, and they swing wildly, making shadows move like ghostly dancers. The gentlemen complain bitterly. "We should go back to England," they say. "We should have reached Virginia weeks ago. We must be off course. This voyage is ill-fated." I lie in my bed, angry and discouraged. Captain Newport has been telling us for weeks that we'll see land any day. Maybe we are off course. I am sick of the tween deck, sick of sailing, sick of the storms that come one after another. And this is the most violent storm yet. The sound of crashing waves is a roar in my ears, punctuated by the creaking of the wooden ship. James and Richard lie next to me. "Are we going to die?" James asks. "Will the waves break open the hull?" I hear a loud crack, and it makes me jump. It is followed by frantic squawking, and I realize it is only a chicken crate that has smashed into an ale barrel down below. "Shut up, James," I snap at him. I am annoyed that he could scare me into mistaking a sliding chicken crate for a cracking ship's hull. "Yes, you are going to die. Every one of us is going to die," I say. James begins to whimper, and I am sure he's dripping snot onto the bed. "Oh, do you want your stepmom now?" I taunt him. Richard sits up and slugs me in the arm. "Stop it," he shouts over another rumble of thunder. "Leave him be, you. You stinking jail rat. You're nothing but a common thief." In a second, I'm on my knees. I'm pounding Richard with my fists, punching his face, his shoulders, anywhere I can hit. He is kicking, flailing. He kicks me in the stomach, and I can't breathe. James scoots out of our way and wails for Reverend Hunt. In the shifting shadows, it's hard to see. I swing. My fist connects with Richard's teeth, and I feel my knuckles cut open. Now Richard is on his feet. He whacks me in the side of the head. I feel dizzy, but I jump up, ready to meet him toe to toe. Strong arms close around my chest, dragging me back away. I see Richard's face, blood dripping from his mouth, down his chin. It is not Reverend Hunt who has dragged me away. I will not get a sermon on how fighting is not the Lord's way, how I must learn to act from love instead of anger. No, it is Captain Smith who has hold of me. I know better than to struggle. He drags me to where the chain bolts lie, then releases me.
"Stand on one foot," he orders.
I hesitate a moment, thinking this is a stupid thing he has ordered me to do. He cusses me for my hesitation. It is the first time he has hit me, and it makes me want to run. But there is no place to run to.
"Stand on one foot,"
he shouts. I can do this ridiculous thing, or be cuffed again, harder. It is difficult to balance on the rocking ship, but I try. I lift my left leg, balance on my right. The ship lurches. I stumble to catch myself. I try again, fall against a barrel.
"Do it,"
Captain Smith orders. He is glowering at me.
"Stand on one foot, you fool."
Tears catch in my throat. He is worse than my father. I lift one leg. I balance for a split second, but Captain Smith shoves me, and I fall onto the tween deck floor. I shout in frustration. He stands over me.
"Does it work, Samuel?"
he demands.
"Can you stand on one foot when a storm rocks the ship? Can you keep your footing when I shove you?"
I am bewildered and angry. I shake my head. No, I cannot balance on one leg in a storm. Captain Smith picks up the chains that recently held him prisoner.
"In London it might have worked for you, this standing on your own, treating other boys as if they don't matter. In Virginia it will not work. Do you understand me? The wilderness is like a ship in a storm. We will need one another to survive.
He clamps the irons roughly around my ankles and wrists.
If these blasted gentlemen refuse to learn that fact, then at least my page will learn it. This colony will need to stand on many legs if we are not to be toppled over in the Virginia wilderness.
He goes back to his own bed, and I am left to try to find a comfortable way to sleep in my chains, between two crates.
Land ho!
The shout comes before dawn. It is followed by a loud ruckus up on deck. Whooping and hollering, laughing and stomping. Everyone on the tween deck is awake in an instant. Captain Smith calls across to Reverend Hunt.
Reverend, did you pray up that storm last night? From the sounds of it, it blew us straight to Virginia.
I am cold and stiff from sleeping chained, curled up in a small place like a snail. I rub my eyes. My head hurts and my jaw aches. I need a slop bucket badly, and there is none within reach. I'm too proud to call for help, though, so I grit my teeth and wait. Someone lights a lantern, and men begin to stir. Reverend Hunt marches Richard over to me. His cheek is swollen, and one of his eyes is turning purple. I am proud of my handiwork. Richard looks at me, and I see a half-smile cross his face. I realize I must be purple and swollen, too, for him to look so satisfied. Reverend Hunt clears his throat.
"Richard has something to say," he tells me.
Richard twists his shirt tail around his fingers.
"I'm sorry I hit you," he says quickly. "And I won't call you those bad names any more."
I wonder if he means it, or if he is just obeying Reverend Hunt. But mostly, I am hoping someone will figure out that I need a slop bucket before I soil my slops. Captain Smith ambles over.
"As I remember, it was important for someone to bring me a bucket in the morning, when I was locked in those things,"
he says and yawns.
"But Samuel doesn't need anyone's help, so I suppose we'll just leave him be. That's the way he likes it."
The three of them start to walk away. I'm about to burst. I jump to my feet. "Captain Smith, sir," I call after him. "Might I please have a slop bucket?" Captain Smith looks at me and laughs.
"Me? An officer? Serving my own page? I think not."
I dance from one foot to another. Why is he tormenting me? I certainly can't ask Reverend Hunt to bring it to me. Then I understand. Richard is the only one I can ask, the only one who should be asked to bring a slop bucket to another servant. I groan. I can't wait much longer, or I'll be embarrassed beyond words, and have no clean slops to wear. "Richard!" I try to keep the desperation out of my voice. "I am sorry for punching you last night. Bring me a bucket, would you?" Richard glances at Captain Smith and grins, enjoying his moment of victory. But Captain Smith puts a quick stop to his gloating.
"Don't make the boy wait. Hop to it," he says.
The moment Richard sets the bucket down, I drop my slops, have a seat, and relieve myself. Captain Smith seems satisfied with what I have learned about cooperation, and he unclamps my chains.
"Don't let your anger get the best of you, Samuel," he says. "Learn to channel it, and it will become your strength rather than your weakness."
I have seen that he has been channeling his anger at Mr. Wingfield and Captain Ratcliffe into his writing. He is telling his side of the story. I turn my attention to the excitement at hand. Have we really found Virginia? Master Wingfield pounds on the closed hatch.
"I demand to know what is happening up there,"
he shouts. Finally, the sailors pull open the hatch and send down reports. We have entered a bay. There are tall trees along a sandy shoreline. There is no sign of savages. Then they tell us we're dropping anchor. A party will go ashore to explore. At last we are allowed up on deck for our first sight of Virginia. It is green, quiet, and desolate. There are no natives coming to us in canoes as they did in the Caribbean islands. There are no houses, no huts, just wise old trees in spring leaf, standing guard over the sandy shore. Quiet, desolate, and free. We can pick any place, any piece of forest or meadow, and make it ours. A group of gentlemen and sailors get ready to go ashore.
"Bring picks and shovels,"
Master Wingfield orders. Captain Smith scoffs.
"I suggest we find a place to live before you go digging for gold. We can't eat gold."
Master Wingfield gives him a disdainful look.
"Did you not read your contract to the Virginia Company? The part where it says we are to turn a profit for the company as soon as possible? We will eat the supplies we brought and dig for gold."
The Godspeed and the Discovery are anchored nearby as well. I watch as the longboats are rowed to shore. About 30 men in all disembark for the exploratory trip, most of them gentlemen and sailors. Many of them have their muskets ready with slow matches burning. Those of us who are left spend the day sitting or lying around, either on deck or in the tween deck, waiting. And while we wait, the gentlemen, soldiers, carpenters, laborers, and servants all discuss their ideas about the new world.
"You can't get gold in a day. We'll need to plow and plant and live here a while."
"You won't catch me walking behind a plow. I've got peasants to do that back in England. I say we eat the stores we've brought, get the gold fast, and go home."
"The gold is not where the biggest profit is. I want to explore.
Find the new passage to the Orient the Virginia Company wants. Now that's how to strike it rich. If we can get goods, silk, spices and jewels, from India and China back to England, without having to deal with those Ottoman Turks and their marked-up prices, just think of the profits we will make."
And there is one lone voice, Reverend Hunt, who says he has not come for gold or to find the new passage to the Orient. He says we have been sent by God for more noble purposes, to bring the good news of Christ to the Virginia natives, and to look for survivors from the Roanoke colony. Of course, as soon as he says it, all the other men agree that that's some of why they have come as well. But I know their hearts are set more on gold and profits than on finding lost colonists or saving souls. James and Richard have gotten hold of a deck of cards and are playing and laughing. I am determined to stay out of trouble, so I don't say one mean thing to them all day. When I look at the quiet forest, I wonder what it will be like to live there, to build houses and create a settlement. I wonder what it will be like to do as Captain Smith says and work with the others, rather than keeping to myself the way I have done for so long. It seems to me it will be strange, and I'm not sure I will like it. The cook starts supper. He throws a large chunk of pork and several pounds of peas with water into the cook pot. Later, he adds handfuls of sea biscuits. They are hard enough to break your teeth when they are dry, but in the peas porridge they will become soft and chewy. At dusk we hear voices and look out to see the men returning. They are in good spirits, and I wonder if they've found gold already.
"Just in time for supper,"
declares the cook, and he begins to ladle peas porridge into the mess pots. Suddenly I hear a cry, then frantic shouting and someone moaning. I run to the railing. In the half-light of dusk I see them, five of them, crouched on a hill, their naked bodies painted, arrows flying from their longbows. Already one of the sailors has fallen. "No!" I shout, as if my voice, my objection, can change anything. "Use your muskets! Shoot them!" I hear the command.
"Make ready your piece!"
Our men load their muskets, prime the pan, charge the piece with powder, put in the musket ball, ram down the charge, cock the match. But by the time the first musket shot rings out, the Indians are already leaving, creeping away silently on hands and feet like bears. The musket balls don't even come close to them. The injured men are brought to Dr. Thomas Wooten aboard the Godspeed. A gentleman, Gabriel Archer has been shot through both hands, and a sailor has been shot twice in the torso. I see now that this land is not so free and open. This is Indian land, and they do not want us here. And what is worse, it seems to me that their bows and arrows are quicker, more accurate, and can shoot farther than our muskets. Chapter 9.
Now falleth every man to work. The council contrive the fort. The rest cut down trees to make place to pitch their tents. Some provide clapper to relay the ships. Some make gardens, some nets, etc. William Simons, E.D. The Proceedings of the English Colony in Virginia.
Have we crossed the wide ocean only to be shot by the natives the minute we set foot in Virginia? We servants gather around our mess pot, but no one eats much. James is crying, sniffling, with snot running into his mouth. "I want to go home," he whimpers. Richard keeps his eyes cast down. "Reverend Hunt said we'd tell them about the Bible," he says softly. "He didn't say they'd want to kill us." Henry slaps him on the back with a loud thwack.
"You can't believe everything you hear, my boy."
Abram's wild eye is vibrating off to the side. I try not to look at him. After supper, I go to find Captain Smith. He is sitting with his quill and paper, writing. Now he can add that we finally landed in Virginia, but that the natives do not want us here. I stand, waiting quietly. He finishes filling a page, blots the ink carefully, then looks up at me.
"Yes, Samuel?"
"Sir, how will we make a settlement if this is Indian land? Will we have a war?" He pats a barrel next to him and bids me to sit down.
"The men who came back to England from the Roanoke colony wrote about the Virginia Indians. They are interested in trade, and we have brought the things they prize. Copper, metal, tools, glass beads, needles, mirrors, and such. It will be a delicate balance. But if we can find a piece of land they are not using, and come to them in peace with goods to trade, I believe we can settle here without a war."
He scratches his beard, thinking.
"We must do it without a war. There are many more of them than there are of us."
That night, as we bed down, I feel the rocking of the ship. I try to imagine that we are still out at sea, rather than anchored near this strange new land of Virginia. I wonder if Colin and the other boys at the orphanage were right, that Richard and Reverend Hunt and I will all die here. There is a box we carried with us that was not to be opened until we reach Virginia. It contains the names of the men chosen by the Virginia Company to be our leaders, and directions for us from the Virginia Company. Captain Newport gathers the other ship captains and high-ranking gentlemen on the Susan Constant and opens the box. As he reads the names, at first there are no surprises. The men on our council will be Edward Maria Wingfield, John Radcliffe, Christopher Newport, Bartholomew Gosnold, John Martin, and George Kendall. But when he reads the last name on the list, it causes a big ruckus. That name is John Smith.
"He is still under arrest," Master Wingfield objects.
"The fact that he is out of his chains does not mean his name has been cleared."
"He's a criminal,"
Captain Radcliffe declares.
They raise such a fuss that Captain Smith is not allowed to become a council member. I think Captain Smith would make a better leader than most of the men on the council. But what I think does not matter. Captain Smith seems determined to stay out of trouble, just as I am, and he accepts the council's decision without a fight. To me, in private, he says,
"You will see how quickly they will be begging me for help and advice."
Captain Newport reads more of the orders from the Virginia Company. "Be careful in choosing a site for the settlement. Go up the river where you can keep a lookout, so the Spanish cannot mount a surprise attack. Take great care not to offend the Virginia natives, and begin trading with them for food right away. Do not write letters home that say anything bad about the New World. People in England must not hear a single thing that would discourage them from coming to Virginia. A few carpenters and sailors go ashore and put together the shallop, a small boat meant for exploring that we brought with us in pieces. Then a small group of gentlemen go off to search for a place for us to settle. The reports they come back with are encouraging. They have met lots of natives and have been welcomed into their villages, invited to eat with them and watch their dances. They say we do not need to fear the natives. When I look at Captain Archer's bandaged hands, I hope they are right. They are also mapping the land and water. They say they have found a point of land with deep water all around and named it Point Comfort. They have planted a tall cross at the mouth of the bay where we first landed and named the place Cape Henry. The only discouraging news is that they have seen no sign of survivors from the Roanoke colony. Then finally, on May 13, 1607, 17 days after we first landed in Virginia, our explorers bring us the news we have been waiting for. They have chosen a place for us to settle. It's a place where the river is deep close to shore, so it will be easy to moor our ships to trees. It's got fresh water from the river, rabbits, squirrels, birds, mussels, oysters, fish, crabs, strawberries, and mulberries. It's safe from the natives because there are none living nearby. We'll also be safe from the Spanish because it's on a peninsula and we'll be able to see any approaching Spanish ships for miles down the river. They've named the river the James in honor of King James of England, and our settlement will be called Jamestown. The council votes and selects Master Wingfield as our first president. We sail upstream and moor the ships near our chosen site. They seem small, bobbing in the river beneath towering old trees. Their paint of blue, maroon, and yellow, so rich when we began this journey, is now faded and chipped. They have weathered nearly 5 months at sea, and they show it. As the sun sets, I gaze at what will be our new home. There are high bluffs just upstream, but our site has a sandy shoreline along the river. The trees wave their branches in the breeze, and a huge grey bird circles, calling out his objection to our presence. We bed down for one last night on the Susan Constant. I lie awake most of the night, excited, a bit scared, wondering, waiting for the first rooster crow to signal time to go ashore. The morning of May 14th, even Richard is up and ready before sunrise. I dress quickly and go up on deck to help load the longboat. We pile in as many men and goods as we can, and then the sailors take to the oars and row to shore. When it is my turn, I ride with several of the common men and most of the chicken crates. We unload the crates and set the chickens free to peck around this new world. I wander off a bit before anyone can give me my next task to do. I go a little way into the forest to look around. The trees are so tall, I feel as if I am in a cathedral. I breathe in the rich smell of damp earth. The leaves are a bright early spring green, and sprinkled along the ground are tiny flowers of white, yellow, and violet. Butterflies and dragonflies add to the riot of color. I am either in a cathedral or in paradise, I think. Captain Smith finds me and hands me a straw hat and a hatchet and tells me to get to work. We will begin felling the smaller trees in order to make room for our tents and gardens. James and Richard are assigned to work alongside me. My inclination is to work on my own and ignore them. But would it be so bad to work with them, I wonder, to cooperate? Better than being chained up by Captain Smith again, with no slop bucket nearby. I decide to give it a try. I see that it would be best to have one boy bend a sapling over. another boy chop it at its base with strong downward strokes, and the third boy drag the saplings into a brush pile. I clear my throat. "Do you want to work together on this?" I ask them. I explain my idea. Richard eyes me warily.
"Don't let him bend a sapling for you," he warns James. "He'll let it go and make it snap into your face."
I feel like punching Richard, but I know what that will get me. I stomp off to work by myself. Over the next several days, we boys, servants, labourers, sailors, carpenters, and soldiers work as hard as mules. We set up the tents and bring all the bedding ashore from the ships. We dig up the ground and plant the seed wheat we brought with us from England. We tie string in knots to make nets and put the nets in the river to catch fish. We gather mussels, oysters, and crabs and bring them to the cook. We lug buckets of water from the river for cooking and washing and drinking. We fell some of the big trees and split the logs long ways into planks, making clapboards. We load the clapboards onto the ships so they can be taken back to England to build English houses. We also dig up sassafras root to ship back to England. President Wingfield says it will sell at a very good price because it is used to make medicines. I am so tired by the end of each day that sometimes I fall into bed without bothering to take off my shoes. The days are warm and the nights cool, with the constant sounds of insects and tree frogs lulling us to sleep. Some of the gentlemen pitch in and work hard, but most of them just take turns standing guard, their muskets ready, with slow matches smoking. For several days it seems as if we were all alone in the Virginia wilderness. Then one day I look up from my hoeing and freeze, afraid to move or even cry out. Two native men come walking through the forest, quiet as deer. They each have a longbow slung over one shoulder.
"Halt!"
shouts one of the gentlemen guards. The Indian men keep coming, and I see our guards prepare to fire their muskets.
"Wingapo!"
one of the native men calls out. "Wingapo?" Captain Smith has told me this is their greeting, and it means, "My beloved friend." The Indians hold up baskets, showing us they have brought us something, and they both smile. They are tall, sturdy men, with broad, flat noses and wide lips. For clothing they wear only a breechcloth, like an apron, and their faces and shoulders are oiled with something that gives their skin a deep, reddish colour. Just like Richard heard from the sailors, their hair, jet black, is shaved close on the right side of their heads and grows long past their shoulders on the left side, with a ridge of short hair down the middle. The long side has decorations. One man has shells, and the other has the whole wing of a bird dangling from his hair. Our guards approach them, still carrying their muskets. The taller of the two Indians points to their muskets, then to his longbow. He lays his bow on the ground, motioning to our guards to do the same. I see the gentlemen hesitate, but then they lay down their arms. We gather around the baskets and find ripe red strawberries, purple mulberries, and round loaves of bread made from some kind of coarse meal. It all smells wonderful. Captain Smith joins us and begins to converse with the men, using his hands and words from their language. He gives them glass beads and copper in return for the food they have brought. One of the native men sees me eyeing the bread, and he laughs. He breaks a piece off, hands it to me, and nods as if saying, "Go ahead, eat it." I say thank you, even though I know he doesn't understand. The bread is delicious. After that, the natives come to us nearly every day, sometimes two men, sometimes three. They call out,
"Wingapo,"
when they approach our settlement, and always bring us baskets of food. The natives are happy with the glass beads and copper we give them. Captain Smith explains to me how copper is rare and precious to them, so it is like gold is to the English. and they have no means to make glass, and so the beads, with their bright colours, are to them like rubies, emeralds, and diamonds are to the English. At first I thought the Indians were strange to be willing to trade so much food for a few glass beads, but now I see that it is as if they were trading strawberries for rubies and corn for diamonds. One day Captain Smith surprises us.
"I believe the savages are spying on us," he says. "I've watched the way they look around while they are here. I think they are counting our men, seeing where our tents are located and plotting an attack. We have invaded their land, and I believe they will fight us to get it back. We must build a palisade to protect the settlement." "Nonsense," declares President Wingfield. "You see how friendly they are. If we build a palisade, it will look as if we are their enemies. We will build no fortification."
Captain Smith grumbles, but there is no arguing with President Wingfield, and I think that President Wingfield is right. The Indians have been very friendly and welcoming to us. Captain Smith's suspicion runs like poison through the settlement. What if the natives are spying on us? What if they are planning an attack? How will we protect ourselves with no palisades? The Virginia Company has provided our men with extra weapons and armor. In England, commoners do not carry weapons, but here, almost everyone has them. Still, when the weapons and armor are being issued, by the time they got to the last of the laborers and servants, they ran out. Some of us have no protection at all. Those who have armor begin wearing it all day, even when it is hot. Anyone who has a sword or a musket keeps it at his side. Those of us who have no weapons discuss the merits of protective techniques, like hiding under a mattress. "Their arrows will go right through a mattress, you fool."
"No, they won't. The straw will stop them."
"Yes, they will go right through."
"Won't."
"Will." And so on. On a day filled with bright, hot sunshine, I am digging up a plot, getting it ready to plant more wheat. James arrives with two buckets of water hanging from either end of a yoke, balanced across his shoulders. He lowers the yoke and sets the buckets on the ground so I can drink. I take a ladleful, then spit it out. "It's salty," I complain. I glare at him. Has he done this on purpose, just to spite me? But he flinches as if I might hit him, and I see the innocent look in his eyes. "High tide," he says quickly. "It hasn't rained for a while, and the river mixes with the seawater when the tide is up. It'll be better when the tide goes out, or if it rains. That's what Master Percy said." I take another swallow of the salty water, but it only makes me more thirsty. "Take it away," I say angrily. James slinks off. Reverend Hunt has seen our interaction. He comes over to talk to me.
"Samuel, that poor child is unwanted by his father and despised by his stepmother. You should be able to find more kindness in your heart for him."
I hang my head. I know Reverend Hunt is right, but I have been too tired and too thirsty to think about being kind. That night in our tent, there is more discussion about an Indian attack. Henry and Abram talk of making armor for themselves out of wood. Richard and James discuss what they will do if an attack comes.
"I'm going to run to the ships," says James. "I'll row the longboat out to the Susan Constant and hide in the tween deck. No arrows can get me there."
"You are a stupid, stupid boy," I think. I picture him running toward the ships, with arrows flying all around, and him with no armor. But I don't mock him or tell him he is stupid. I hope Reverend Hunt would appreciate my effort to be more kind. Chapter 10.
The people in all places kindly entreating us, dancing and feasting us with strawberries, mulberries, bread, fish, and other their country provisions, whereof we had plenty, for which Captain Newport kindly requited their least favors with bells, pins, needles, beads, or glasses. which so contented them that his liberality made them follow us from place to place, and ever kindly to respect us. Captain John Smith, a true relation of such occurrences and accidents of note as hath appeared in Virginia.
Captain Newport goes off exploring with 8 or 9 gentlemen and 12 sailors. They leave in the shallop, the small boat they put together here in Virginia, so they will be able to navigate the narrow riverways. He takes Captain Smith along to be an interpreter with the Indians. They go in search of gold and silver, and to find that new passage to the Orient everyone is talking about. They don't take many provisions with them. They say the last time they went exploring, each time they approached a village, the natives invited them in and fed them like kings. In Jamestown we continue to work. We build a chapel for Reverend Hunt. We hang an old sail between 4 trees as an awning to protect us from sun and rain, and nail a bar between 2 trees for the pulpit. The walls are rails of wood that let the sunlight right in, and logs on the ground are our pews. Reverend Hunt calls us together for prayer, to thank the Almighty for all that we have, and to ask for protection. It still has not rained, and our wheat fields and gardens are wilting. We have found no fresh water springs nearby, and so we are still dependent on the river for water. Richard James and I spend the afternoon bringing buckets of water from the river to dump on the tiny new shoots. When I take a drink, I find it is still salty, and I wonder if we are killing the young plants rather than saving them. Richard and James keep to themselves, talking to each other, but not to me. I think about what Reverend Hunt said about being kinder to James, but if they treat me as if I am not there, how can I be nicer? Maybe not yelling at them, not calling them names, not hitting them. Maybe that is enough. After supper there is evening prayer in the new chapel. Reverend Hunt says we will have common prayer every morning and evening from now on, and 2 sermons on Sundays. By dusk I am so tired.